Welcome to Conquering Leadership. This is the next in a series of interviews with interesting people in real life situations and getting their views on leadership in the modern world, different industries, different backgrounds, and different countries. So today our guest is John Dyke. John Dyke's an academy director at Goals Soccer, which is part of the Manchester City football organization. For our folks out there listening, I know many out there are from different countries. So when John and I speak to football, we will be speaking to the round ball version, not the Australian rules version or the NFL version. So apologize in advance if we don't use the word soccer, but for us, football is very much a word to describe that sport. So coming back to that, John does actually come from Manchester, a city which has got some interesting history. The lady who founded the suffragette movement, Emily Pankhurst, was from Manchester. It's historically famous for textiles and fashion industry. It's got the oldest English language library, established in 1653. And those of you who know, Alan Turing did a lot of mathematics work at the University of Manchester, but probably in the world of sport, it's most famous for supporting two, not one, but two professional football teams, Manchester City and Manchester United. And our friend today, John, has worked for both of those organisations. And no matter how much we'd like to dig into the sport of football, which I'm sure we will on the way through, we are very much exploring the world of leadership. And John, welcome to the show. What would you like to add to the introduction?
Did you mention the music scene in Manchester as well?
I remember the music club scene evolving, and Oasis and the Smiths are the two biggest names I remember from Manchester.
I think you've sort of summarised the history of the town, and I do consider myself a Manchester lad, and Manchester is always home. But I've been very fortunate, you know, throughout my working life, which has mainly been within football, but also on an educational side as well. I've had a lot of international experiences with both the two clubs that you've mentioned, so I have been fortunate to do some work and projects for both those two clubs. I remember meeting yourself, Baker and Spice, Nanjing Lu, 2010, if I remember rightly.
Wow, that's a good memory.
When I was actually working at the Nike HQ in Shanghai, and I was there running the Manchester United Soccer Schools projects. So we have got the word soccer in there as well, which is good. So we're ticking a few boxes as we go along.
A bit of diversity and inclusion there on your part. Well done, John.
I remember meeting for the first time, and I remember we had a coffee, and I think it was a Danish, and we were just talking about life and coaching, and you know, and I think we had a lot of similarities in our views, and also in some of our values around the coaching. So it's always great to have those international experiences. And I was fortunate enough to, as yourself, live in Shanghai, work in Shanghai. And whilst living there for 5 years, I had a great opportunity to explore major cities, North and South China. And then my journey has taken me to LA in California. So I've been there for the last, almost 2 years now in California. And I think you called it out before, but running the academies for Manchester City Football Group at Goals Soccer Centres. And so everything's on the west coast of California and based around sort of LA. So I've been very fortunate in my time in the industry. And I'd like to say that, you know, I've had some different experiences along the way. And hopefully we can discuss some of those experiences and maybe even a couple of stories today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fantastic, rich background you've got there. So let's come back a little bit to football and education. And You and I both believe strongly in sport as a supplement or a form of education, particularly for young people. So can you give us a few specifics around football and why it's educational?
Well, I mean, I think it's educational for life. So I think sport is educational for life. So it's it's quite an interesting one that, and I think people, you hear this all the time, but I think playing any sport gives you the life skills that you need. So it's an education on life, so communicating, teamwork, being committed, being part of something, feeling part of something. I think, human nature dictates that's when you're at your best, when you feel part of something, you feel that you're achieving things with other people. But I think any sort of sport, and certainly the invasion game, so you think about rugby, you think about football, basketball, all those provide you the life skills that you're going to need. Every child, every person plays sport because it's fun, because they enjoy it. And that's the basis of it, and that should even be in the professional world, that they're playing because they enjoy it, sort of number one. But I think off the back of that, you get all those life skills that make you a better person in life, respect, following the rules, trying to achieve something, helping others. So life education in sport, I think, is there. It's there for everyone to see. And I think it's very, very important. But more so now, that education probably comes at the same level as, or certainly that learning, as the same level as people wanting to perform and make careers of it. You're going to have to educate yourself. You're going to have to educate yourself to progress in any sport.
That's a really interesting observation, because there seems to be in society as a whole this tendency to look at sports people as, wow, I wish I was a professional athlete, rather than doing a proper job kind of thing. And you and I both know how difficult it is not to just be recognized as a professional athlete, but then to maintain that life with all the pressures that come with it. So what kind of insights can you share on this thread of education in development, talent development? And we're very much in the industry of talent development, where around what it takes for a young athlete to get there and stay there.
I think it's a good question, and I love that question. And if you want to stay at the top of your game, you've got to be a lifelong learner. So whether you're a coach, whether you're a manager, whether you're working in industry, but now athletes have to have that thirst. They have to learn. They have to be a progressive learner. They have to have a lifelong learning scope and vision, and keep going, because you will not always stay at the top. If you don't progress, you don't develop, you don't learn new things, you won't stay at the top of your sport. You won't stay at the top of your profession. So I think it's massive. I think, everybody involved in sport now needs to be a lifelong learner. They should have that thirst to learn something all the time and continue learning. And that might even mean adapting or changing what they already know, And I think there's some great examples of how not only football has changed, but all sports have changed. And those that don't change with it, drop off.
Absolutely. So, oh man, you've opened up already. I love these conversations, because you've opened up a whole bunch of pathways there. So, what in your time in football, what are some of the changes that you've seen? I cast my mind back to the early 90s, and there's some fantastic characters. But, the game has evolved so fast. So what do you think some of the key changes are in the game of football that bring us to the modern game today?
And it's interesting, because I think Ancelotti said it the other day in one of his interviews for Everton. He said, there's still two goalposts, the pitch is still the same size, there's still one ball, and there's 11 players on each team. So the game itself hasn't changed. But if you want to be successful at that game, then you have to change within that framework. So the game is the framework. So you think about that. There's some small, subtle changes in the game, like the back pass rule for football, etc. You think about VAR coming in and the controversy, the current situation in the Premiership. But also, I think there's more of that international exchange, not just of players, but of chances of people playing against international teams that maybe wouldn't have played against them before. So there's different styles, there's different cultures in there and different ways to play that game. And then I suppose one of the biggest changes in the last 10 years or so is the pitches, the facilities, the sports science behind it all, the psychology behind sports. So everything that's around the game that isn't that 90 minutes, but are those supporting mechanisms and the teams that support it. So, you look at the pitches that they played on in the 70s, the football pitches, and I'm sure it's the same for rugby. But, they were farmers' fields, and now they're like bowling greens. Stadiums, the latest stadiums with excellent changing rooms and ice baths and great showers. And then throughout the week when you're training at the best facilities with sports scientists, nutritionists, psychologists, club doctors. So everything there to support you to get to that 90 minutes of the game is far, far superior than it ever was. You can think of times as well when people like Arsene Wenger first came over and started managing Arsenal and changed the diets of the players, changed the culture of the players. And I think it's interesting. I know we were talking a few weeks back about culture and how that changes things. He changed everything. And now the modern player is very, very different than the players of the past. We probably don't have as many characters, and maybe that's because they're all wealthy people. People that play football are millionaires. You're watching millionaires play sport, and I watch across on the local fields opposite my house. I see kids playing out there for fun in the rain because they have the passion for the game. So it's interesting. I think that's how sports changed in the last 10 years or so.
And you and I both come from an era of, kicking a footy around in the park, and I've played in a few muddy bogs with a few cowpats for sure over time, but when you look at culture there, and you've just flashed up a very interesting subject in the terms of, you look back at where football started, actually. And I don't know if the Netflix show that speaks to it is correct, but it became the sport of the common man. What, about 100 years ago? Well, a lot longer than 100 years ago. And do you think that's still its appeal today? Even though the players are super wealthy professionals, do you think the game still has an appeal for the common person?
I'm going to say yes as a football fan. I think football's embedded, certainly in the culture in the UK, and you look at it in the South American, the Latino countries, the Spanish, the Portuguese, and the South American countries. There's a passion for it. It's part of life. It's not just a game. It is part of life, and it's part of life that you can go and play, and you can be your hero on the local park. You can be Messi if you support Barcelona as a kid playing on your local field, and you can have that connection with the club. I think it's still a game that appeals across to everybody. I don't think the wealthiest people become the best players. You look at some of the most talented players in the world from a range of different countries. So it's not one country. They tend to come from hardship. And working class families. Now, it doesn't mean that they are more talented than someone that's more affluent, but they have more drive, more hunger. This is their chance to do something. I think the modern world, probably where sport suffers slightly, is that everything's easily accessible. You can watch games on TV, you can get on your computer and watch games. I think sport is so much more accessible that takes away some of the hunger. And the more affluent you are, the more access you have to sport, and therefore it becomes the norm. When it's something special and you're hungry for that, and you can't wait for Saturday at 3 o'clock as it used to be to play the game or to watch the game, it's something different. Now, if you miss that 3 o'clock kickoff, there's one at 5:30, and then there's one at 7 o'clock. And Sunday, all those kickoffs will be repeated, and then there'll be new games, and then there's Monday night football. Then there's Tuesday night football, now Friday night football, you know, and it's just sort of endless. So I just think things have become more accessible to everybody. So I won't say it's a game that isn't accessible to everybody, and everybody isn't passionate about it. But I think you'll find that some of the talent will come from the less affluent areas.
So. And I think you've just touched on it. Its appeal around the world is the fact that it's accessible and very easy to play if you just want to go out and have some fun. And you mentioned fun earlier, and I feel that in the world of sport, particularly at age grade level, when you know, kids, boys and girls are younger, some of the fun, well, the fun is, to my mind, the most important ingredient for keeping athletes of any level involved in the game.
Ultimately, yes, it's the main driver. It should be fun. Should be fun for everybody. You know, that's what gets you playing. You know, that enjoyment. I mean, you've probably heard it under the current climate that a lot of players in sport. You know, I heard, I think it was Ian Botham talking, even cricket. So you know, I'm trying to diversify from football because I think this is a cross sport where he was saying that, you know, they want their crowds back in.
Yeah.
Because that's the fun and passion that they're doing it. You know, they want the opposition fans to be shouting at them. This drives them on and gives them that fun and enjoyment, you know, as much as anything else. So I think this is a cross sport that the players will get their fun and enjoyment, but also I think it's a fans, you know, that they see it when the fans are happy and they're cheering because it's a great shot. You know, they hit a boundary in cricket and the fans are then, and that sort of pleasure rubs off on them, and that gives them that, you know, pleasure as well and that enjoyment. So I do think it's across all sports. You know, it's whether you're a fan, a spectator, a player, or involved in sport, there should be that fun, that excitement element.
No, 100%. And for our American audience, a boundary in cricket is similar to a home run in baseball, just to do a bit of interpretation there. So quick question, bringing it back around to leadership. Please explain VAR. What is the VAR and why is it controversial? Or it seems from where I've been looking at it to be quite a controversial decision.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's the virtual reality referee. So, you know, that monitors the whole game. So if the referee on the pitch in real time makes a decision that is... I'm tempted to not use the word, but the wrong decision, because that's probably a bit unfair. But if there's a clear and obvious mistake, the referee can go and have a look at a VAR monitor and maybe change his decision. So that's probably the easiest way of explaining it. It's a bit like, you know, Hawkeye in the tennis that's been there, manages when the ball goes over the line, where, you know, you've seen McEnroe in the past where he's gone, oh, the ball was in, and, you know, having the big argument with the umpire. Well, now they just play the video and go, actually, it was out. You know, and it's the same with VAR. It doesn't tell any lies. It tells the truth. It's just how far can you take sport, because you can only replicate VAR at the very top elite level. So when the kids are playing on the park, they don't have VAR. It's a goal or it's not a goal. It's off the pitch or it's not on, you know, Saturday, Sunday football in the local leagues, they don't have VAR, you know. So why should that then be different at the very top level? And it's because of the finances that are involved in some of those finite decisions.
Right. And for the spectator, and I have one very vocal lover of football, which is my brother. He's a massive fan and he's incensed by VAR. And he claims to be not the only one in this spectator community. I agree with your points philosophically. At the top level of competition, we need to, partly because of the speed of the game, assist the officials in making, you know, better judgments, if you like. But why do you think some of the community side or the spectator side are rattled by it?
I think it's like anything in life. It's something new. It's a change. It holds the game up, so the game doesn't flow the same. I think as human beings, whichever country you're from, you like to debate on sport, and sometimes this can be too clinical. You know, that was offside. No, it wasn't. It was onside. And I think that some of the challenges with VAR is that it's anything that new that happens. So it could be a new ruling in sport. It could be technology that is there to support ultimately, because that's what it's there to do. It's to make it and make sure decisions are correct. And it's just how they do it, how they use VAR. And it's getting that consistency and standardisation, because I think what you're getting is some referees haven't been called out by VAR to go and have a look at a decision. And some referees have been called out. Some referees have gone and looked at the monitor at the side of the pitch. Other referees have listened to somebody else that's then looked at those pictures to make the decision or to advise him on the decision. I think ultimately the referees will get used to it and be a bit more braver and say that I've made the decision, I've looked at it on the video, and I'm still sticking with my decision.
I think
there's a few things. I think it will get right. I think it will get there. But at the minute, it's not just the VAR. There's a lot of complications around, certainly in football. And I know similar tools like VAR are used in other sports, but in football is the handball rule. So, it's not a clear and obvious how it used to be in the old days. Somebody stuck the hand out to stop the ball going past. What they're saying now is somebody's had a shot at 60 mile an hour and it's hit your hand and that's handball. Well, that's ridiculous, in my opinion.
Yeah, we could go down the technology road. And I think in tennis and cricket, it seems to work quite well. And I know in rugby, what frustrated me in the early days, it makes sense to me, but what I've noticed or I feel has occurred in rugby is the referees are no longer trusting their own decisions and relying on the technology where it needs to be. We need to empower, and as a leadership aspect, we need to empower the referees to be confident. I think the football referees I've seen are pretty good, to be honest. And we just need to empower them to trust their own decisions and use the technology as a support mechanism rather than replace them. And then we keep the human aspect in the game.
There's a debate, Angus, that you could almost do it like the basketball and other sports. Whereas, do you know what? If you're the manager or the coach of that team, you have three opportunities to question that. But that's it. So, you know, I think cricket's another one. But, you know, you've got a couple of opportunities to question that decision. Then we can look at VAR. But that's it. Once you've used those three, you're just going off the referee's decision. So that might be something that may come in the future. That's a bit controversial, I know. But other sports seem to be successful with that. So it's not stopping it all the time. You have to be clever when you use, you know, those, when you really think that referee has made a wrong decision.
Very good point. And I'm going to come back to that in a little minute, because what I'd like to do is ask you, in terms of leadership, what for you defines leadership?
I knew we'd get around to it at some point. I knew we'd get around to the topic of leadership, which is good. And I don't think my views differ much from other people, because I believe that leadership is the action of influencing, you know, either individuals or a group of people, could even be an organisation, to achieve something. You know, that's leadership, to do the best that they can to achieve something. So, you know, I think that's it in a summary. If I could summarise it in one line, that is what it would be.
And what for you makes up the attributes of a good leader?
It's an interesting one, because I think leadership doesn't automatically happen. So you might be at the top and you might be the manager, you might be the CEO, but just because you've reached that pay grade doesn't mean that you're a leader. I think a good leader establishes a direction and creates this a decision that leaves other other people feeling empowered. I think you mentioned it before with the referees, but I think that's what it is. You're leaving other people empowered, or a team of people, or a group of people, to achieve their goals, you know. And sometimes this can be achieved without any authority or any micromanagement. You know, if you are empowering people to make decisions, but they have that vision, and we probably will talk about it in a bit, but I know that Eddie Jones, and he's probably a key influencer of some of my leaderships, and he does inspire me when I listen to him. And he's always saying that, you know, he's empowering his players to make decisions, and he empowers the team to get where they want to go. But what he does is he provides the vision. So this is the vision. This is what we're trying to achieve. This is where we want to go. How are we going to do it? You know, and I think that a good leader does that. I think they're the characteristics of a good leader.
Absolutely. Eddie Jones is a big figure, and we'll come back to him in a minute. When yeah. When you were younger, yeah, who were your who inspired you on your journey?
Yeah, I think that's a real interesting one as well, and I think we've probably touched on this in conversations in the past. But I think you probably go through the ages and stages of life, and I think this maybe changes, you know. And I think also you get inspired by maybe people that don't realise that they're leaders and they are inspiring you, but they're not even trying to be. I mean, I'll give you some examples, and I know that you've met me, Angus, and you know, you probably wouldn't think it, but rugby was my game as a child, as a youth, I should say. I think it'd be being a bit unfair saying a child. But as a youth, and you know, I started off back row. I went to a grammar school. I played at Ashnod Mersey, which is a club in Manchester, in Sale, on a Sunday. I played for the grammar school on a Saturday, which was Sale Boys Grammar School. And I was back row until third year. Everybody else then had their growth spurt. I stayed relatively the same size, and I ended up going to scrum half and playing scrum half. But I remember when we were at Ashton, I was watching the first team players and watching the effort that they put into training and how they all bonded together, the way that they were. And again, I think we're going back to that original conversation about life skills, the way how well-mannered they were off the pitch, but absolute animals on the pitch. And that sort of inspires you, and you think, I want to be part of something like that. And I went on to play rugby for many years, and until about the age of 19, where I changed over to football. And that doesn't mean that I hadn't played football. I always played street football, played with my mates. But the organised sport that I was good at was rugby. But I think those players that were playing for Ashton first team, and the past players that had played for the grammar school, and even a couple of the teachers that taught us rugby at the school and took us on tours to Wales, they sort of inspired you. And now whether they were trying to, whether these other players were trying to, I don't know. So I think there's some inspiration there. I think you get inspiration through other people in life. You've seen some great acts of charity work. You've seen some great acts of people talking about the planet and how we need to change this. And you think, wow, that is so inspiring. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, inspiration comes from a set of values and ethics. And I think if you've got a similar values and ethics, you can be inspired by somebody. Because I think that's taking you on that journey. And as we said before, to achieve something, do you know what? I really like what he said there. And I would say that throughout my time, I've took little bits from everybody. I remember on a holiday in Wales this year, and I'm sorry, I'm, you know me, Angus, I'll probably talk forever. But, you know, even my niece, we were all playing football on the beach. Now, I have a couple of nephews that are good footballers. And they were playing, and the dads were playing, and the niece doesn't really play football, but she likes to get involved. And she came on, and she was, you know, she actually listened to what was being said to her, and she played better than some of the lads, and she's not even a player. And that sort of inspired me, that I thought, wow, you know, listen, you know, she's been listening, she wants to learn, she's prepared to give something a go, Whereas the lads, my nephews, who think they're great soccer players, and they're okay, by the way, you know, not prepared to listen. They know it all. You know, 12 years old, they know everything about soccer, you know, football, you know, slipping into US mode there. But, you know, they know everything at 12 years old. Yeah. Whereas, you know, my niece, and that was quite inspiring. And that's something different. It's a bit of inspiration from somewhere else. But, you know, that happened this year.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've noticed on my coaching and coach education journey some of the gender differences in how, you know, female players generally are more open to learning. I know this is a very broad brushstroke, but it seems to be more open to learning, whereas boys seem to think they've got it all worked out already at the youngest of ages and seem to know it all. And that behavioural trait doesn't seem to have any demographic or any nationality boundaries around it.
I really
like the idea that inspiration comes from a set of values and ethics. And I'd like to dig a little bit deeper in there, because I remember as a youngster, whether I was trying to study or play whatever sport I was doing, looking at other players, older boys who I looked up to, whether it was football, rugby, cricket, I wanted to be like them. And on my coach education journey, I try and help coaches understand you are just someone else's mum or dad. But for the players, it's their mates that they play for or fight for or aspire. So now young athletes tend to, particularly the more they go competitive and high performance, they become a little bit self-centered, which is sort of understandable because of the performance requirements. So if the inspiration is linked to values and ethics, how do you define your values and ethics to be an inspiration to people, whether it's like your niece there or other people that might not be family but strangers?
Yeah, I think, and again, I really love that question because it's, you know, it covers such a wide range there. And I think one of the things for me is if you have good ethics and values in life as a person, throughout your day, every day, you could be inspiring other people without knowing. And I think, you know, having good ethics and values and being polite to people, being respectful of other people. Also, I think being respectful that other people may have different views, but they also may have different values. And you know what? That's okay. It is okay. It's just understanding where you are, what your values in life are. It's like when you're bringing your children up, you know, what's the old saying? You know, they know what's right and they know what's wrong. Well, they only know what's right and wrong what you've told them. So another household could have a different set of rules for what's right and what's wrong, you know. And I think just through life, you have to say that these are my values. This is what I believe in. I want to be a good person to anybody else. They may have done wrong to you, but does that mean that you do wrong back? You keep your set of values. And what one of the good inspiring leaders, and I was very fortunate to not to have a relationship, not even to have a close working relationship, but to have been in his company on several occasions, was Sir Alex Ferguson. You know, and everybody knows this story that, you know, he would go in, he would know the cleaners, the dinner ladies, he would ask them how they were, he would know their families, ask them how the sons and daughters were doing at school, he'd know them by name. And I think it's just that, it's knowing people, it's being a good communicator and not afraid, and it's having good values, and that we're all here and we're all trying to work towards the same thing. And I think that's what I do in my leadership. I try and surround myself with like-minded people with the same ethics and values, different characters, of course, because you don't want a team that's you know, robotic, and the same with a coaching team. You know, you want different characters, but we are all trying to achieve the same thing, and we'll all go about it in the way that we believe is the right way to do things. So, it's an interesting one that I don't know whether I have the answer. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that would articulate a better answer than that. But that's how I feel.
So just very quickly for our more international audience, can you give us just a quick outline of who Sir Alex Ferguson is?
So Alex, well, yeah, I'll be surprised if some of them don't know. I think he is a bit of a global phenomenon. You know, probably the most successful manager of Manchester United Football Club.
And his career spanned how long? Was it 20 plus years?
Yeah, 25 years. You know, winning absolutely every trophy that it was possible for him to win. But I think some of the good things about Sir Alex Ferguson are his ethics and values around the training ground, not just around the first team, but also in life. You know, hard working, came from a Glaswegian background, working on the docks. You know, comes from a background of hard work. You know, you don't get anything without hard work. Comes from a background of, you know, you need to prepare. Whatever you're going to do in life, doesn't matter what it is, whether it's in the sporting industry or any other industry, you need to prepare well, and you need to respect other people, regardless of, you know. And I think one of his good qualities was that he did respect everybody, but he also, you know, looked at opponents and did have respect for certain opponents, other managers, and so many managers at the professional and elite level have quoted him as being their mentor and their support mechanism. Now, remember that some of these guys had their teams playing against him in 3 weeks' time, and yet he was prepared to mentor and support and share ideas with them. Not necessarily his tactics with his team and what teams he was going to play, but as a person.
Well, that's a great example of collaborative competition, isn't it? Bringing out other people up around you. And so just staying on the theme of surrounding yourself by the right people, you've named Sir Alex Ferguson football and also a couple of others as inspirational leaders in your professional journey. So we've got Sir Clive Woodward, rugby, Eddie Jones, rugby, and Kobe Bryant, basketball. And what have you extracted from, what's the essence that you've extracted from those three characters, or outside of Alex Ferguson, but the other three characters, to make your own leadership cake?
Yeah, I think there's little bits from them all. I think you know, Sir Alex Ferguson and Eddie Jones, you look at all their, if you like, their mantras, you know, preparation, effort, attitude, you know, doing things right. So I think, you know, Eddie Jones, you see him in several interviews quoted of giving the players ownership, you know, and, you know, he talks on several different occasions about he wants the players to make the decisions. And I think one of his most famous quotes is, he says, "I'm here, my job is to make myself redundant." So in other words, I've surrounded myself with the right people. They all know the vision. They all know where we've got to get. And now I want to let them get on with it and empower them to make decisions along the way. Yep. I think Sir Alex Ferguson, very respectful of people, did a very similar thing, looked at individuals within a team structure, treats everybody as the person that they are, as the individual, but also has a team goal, a team vision. But everyone within that team is an individual. So Clive Woodward was an inspiration, you know, not only obviously with England and the Rugby World Cup, but the way he looked at other sports and had a look at, you know, what transferable skills or what transferable knowledge is there within other sports, you know. And I still like to do that now. I mean, even today on this call, I've talked about, I don't know, two or three different sports that I take little bits from, and little bits from coaches and the way they do things. I don't think you should be blinkered. I think you should be open. I think you've got to change. I think you've got to have a thirst for knowledge. And Clive Woodward for that would do. And then the recent one, Kobe Bryant, and I don't know too much about basketball, but I have started watching it recently in the States a little bit more for obvious reasons. It's great entertainment. It's accessible. And just Kobe Bryant as a person and what he wanted to give back to communities, and everything around the sport when he's a top elite athlete that didn't really need to do that. He could have just focused on his basketball, but he was quite prepared to go beyond the boundaries of basketball. And he had a thirst for knowledge, you know, even at that level that he played at. I think when he was coaching, you know, his daughter, you know, he was asking other coaches that had never been anywhere near the level of basketball that he was at how to do it. So just because he'd been a good player, he didn't disregard the expertise of other people, or he respected other people from what he could learn from, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Bit of philanthropy, bit of humility. And so that's fascinating. And so in this world of leadership, and we draw our inspiration and the essence of our own leadership from others, how do we better maintain our own value sets and ethics under the pressures? And so if you're in a coach, you're a coach educator, you're an academy director, I suspect you get a ton of pressure from coaches, players, parents alike. And those things can corrode your own ethics and value sets. And you shared with me a fantastic story around you had to change the way people were playing in your local community, which was going to actually have initially a negative impact on results on the field. And but you had to have the courage to move forward. And the long-term gain in that is actually a team that's now beats all comers. So that's a courageous decision, John, and well done you. So how do you manage those pressures in your leadership role when you've got all those extra stakeholders wanting to be heard and wanting you to do it their way?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think anyone that's in the vocation of coaching, managing, likes to be under a bit of pressure. I think that the pressure is good. I think that's what makes you perform. I think going back to your point of ethics and values never change. I think what happens sometimes is, you know, that you, and this is probably a quote from all of those inspirational leaders, I think I probably heard them all say it at one time or another, is you have to pick those battles that you're going to win. So, you know, that there's some things that you probably won't be able to influence straight away, but there's some things that you think, do you know what, I can influence this right now. So you need to act on that, and you need to have, I call it courage, and be courageous and say, I can do that, I can act on this. But I've also got to consider, you know, where do I want to go and what do I want to change? But this might take some time. And then there's also that proportion of whether it's cultural, whether it's mindset, that you'll never be able to change. And just eventually you'll say, if I can change all this, then that eventually won't be a factor anymore. You know, those problems, those challenges, that pressure won't be a problem anymore because they won't exist because we will have got all these components right. So I think that pressure that you're talking about, maybe, and how do you keep it? Keep your values. Keep everything that you have as a human being. Know what you can affect immediately. Put a plan in place or a vision in place, strategy, whatever you want to call it, of those things that you want to affect over a period of time, and then forget about the things that you can never change. You're never going to affect them.
So you could say that a positive coaching philosophy and a set of positive values ultimately solve problems in themselves, as long as you're consistent and true to those traits.
100%. You have to create that environment. And I can go back 10 years when we were having these conversations, Angus, you know, about creating this positive environment, positive mindset. Yeah. You know, people, and especially young people in that development stage of sport, are a product of their environment.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got to set the scene for that. But probably more so in leadership is you're having your team that understand what that positive environment is, how to manage that positive environment and go and do it. And that's instilling that in your team. And that's the vision, to create that positive learning environment.
So very good. So I've got a split decision here, John.
Go on.
I'd like to tackle both these subjects, and we do have enough time. So either education styles, so differences. You've been in Asia, you're now in the UK, and your current professional role is based in the US. So cultural learning styles or mental health awareness, which one would you like to pick on first?
Let's start with the cultural sort of stuff, you know, because that's an easy one, and it's quite close to my heart. And you know, I think sometimes when you're in a different culture, you've got to understand what's required at the right time. You know, I can give you, you know, people have different values of what's, you know, we just talked about values, but culturally they may be very, very different. You know, associating what is perfect, you know. What is perfect to one culture is very, very different to another. How they get to that end product, and you'll know, Angus, we're working at Shanghai Rugby Club, and some of the challenges with your coaches and staff, they were good people, but they had a different way from getting to A to B, and sometimes you have to just bring them back and put them back on track with where you want to go. You know, I think we all want to deliver the highest quality, and we want our teams to deliver the highest quality, whatever industry, whatever sport you're in. But the reality is that it can be quite different. You know, you've got to put some compromises in place. You've got to understand and learn the culture.
Do you mean in your leadership role, you've got to be flexible and not look at them as problems, look at them as, you know, you may be the problem, not them.
No, I mean 100%. But that doesn't mean that they can't be the problem. So I think what you've got to do is you've got to try and identify people that are maybe a bit more open to your ideas, but also understand why they wouldn't be open to your ideas. And this is something that's been ingrained for hundreds of years, and you've been there for 3 years. So, you know, how are you going to change that? You might never, ever change it. And this is a case of, you know, sometimes those battles, I'm never going to change that. That's ingrained in them. But what I can do, I can open them up to a different way of thinking or a slightly different pathway, so it's not as rigid. You know, the cross-cultural leadership challenge is probably, one of the biggest ones that you'll have. And I say it, you've all heard it, pick your battles, the ones you want to win. And you might have to pick your battles to win the war. Ultimately, at the end of the day,
here's an interesting thought, particularly in the current world where we seem to be straying to a little bit more nationalistic outlook. You see a lot of this being perpetuated in the news. Do you notice similarities? A lot of businesses, organizations have multi-ethnic, multicultural employees now, much like a football team would have. Do you notice similarities in how people learn, independent of whatever background they come from?
That's an interesting one. Probably something that I'm not overqualified to sort of answer. I mean, you know, one thing on the sort of leadership side, I can tell you that, you know, let me give you some examples of China. I mean, I think that they learned in a very, very different way than I learned. Whether that's because they'd only been exposed to a certain way of learning, because you can get Chinese people, you can get English people, you can get South American, you can get Latino people that have experienced other different cultures and ways of working and living and changed the way they do things. But I think if you're talking about an isolated person that has never left their local town and only ever been to their local school, then they will learn a certain way. I think if somebody's been exposed, I mean, this is the international and cultural experience. We're all people on the same planet. I think cultural experiences, international experiences are important. You know, and if I can, let me try and give you sort of, you know, an example that if you have to explain everything to people, you're never really going to know what that outcome's going to be. You need to sort of set the tone for people and let them find their own way there. And that might be the way that they process information. It might be the way that they learn. You know, and one of the good quotes there is that if you manage or you lead and you've got a culturally diverse team, it's like eating with a knife and fork. So you think about, you're eating with your knife and fork. Okay. Yep. They're two very different tools. Well, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, they're both putting food in your mouth. You use them in different ways, but they're still achieving something. You know, so that cultural intelligence, that's the thing that will enable you to, when to use the fork, when to use the knife to cut something. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's about getting that food off your plate and into your mouth. I don't know whether that's a very good way of...
I think it is a good...
There's a good one. Yeah. Chopsticks in China, they do the same job as knife and fork, but you learn and you eat with chopsticks, but a knife and fork does the same job, but they do it in very, very different ways.
Well, yes, and I think that's quite a good analogy, because I remember being brought up in South London with a very specific set of rules around how to use a knife and fork. And as I got a bit more older and a bit more aware of my surroundings, I noticed Americans used a knife and fork in a different fashion. And then suddenly off you go to Asia and they're using chopsticks, a completely different set of tools. And ultimately we're still achieving the same outcome, which is to get the food we want to eat into our mouth. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's some good insights there. Enable people to achieve the outcome and don't be too rigid on which tools they use to get there if the quality of output remains. So, men, let's have a look at mental health, because it's right under the surface of athletes right now. And you go back to the 90s where football had just become professional, you know, in the premiership sense, rugby followed suit, and everyone's jealous of people, you know, getting a salary to play the sport they love. But fast forward a generation or to now, and all this stuff's coming out about mental health issues around athletes, not just in team sports, but also Olympic, you know, a single person track and field type events. How as leaders, let's look at the leadership side of that. What's our impact in creating that problem, and how do we solve it?
That's a $1 million question, isn't it? You know,
I don't expect a $1 million answer.
Yeah, if we could say, so, yeah, we'd be on a winner. I mean, I quite like to do this, but probably take that away from sport and just saying in life. I think mental health in life and the awareness of mental health issues has been overlooked. It's been put into a position where people are afraid to come forward. It's been seen as a sign of weakness. And again, certainly in sport, it's probably been a sign of weakness. But I think, you know, a good leader will try to understand individuals. So individuals within their team, within their group, and realize that everybody has good days and everybody has bad days. So, you know, everybody can't be there all the time. You're going to have good days, you're going to have bad days, you know, and you can't know what somebody else is going through. You know, it might be in their personal life. It might be something sporting. It might be even carrying an injury, you know. But what you can do is you can always create a positive and safe environment for people to express themselves. So if you've got an issue or a challenge, this is the environment. You can say it. It's not a problem, you know. And I think that balance in life is important. You know, I think you've got to get to know, you've got to know your, and if I bring it back to sport, if it was my team or my squad or my coaches, I've got to get to know about them in their own lives and their personal lives as much as their coaching world, as much as their playing world. I've got to know about them as people to try and understand it a little bit better. But I want to create that environment where, you know, we can talk about things. We can talk about personal stuff. And you know what? Yeah. Today has been a bad day and this has happened.
Yeah.
But what you say to them people is, don't worry, because everybody has those days. You know, and that might happen.
Isn't it funny how we as a race have created shame around something that's actually a very human issue. It's not specific to any one group of people or any one ethnicity.
No, it's everywhere.
It's a byproduct of life,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. And it's probably more of a byproduct of modern life as well, Angus. You know, look at the current situation with with COVID restrictions, lockdowns. You know, I don't think it's human nature to be locked up. I don't think it is. I think we're sociable creatures, and you know, we want to be out there and we want to meet other people. We even like the face-to-face contact. I mean, think about the world changing now with coaches not shaking hands anymore, or, you know, saying hi to players in very, very different way. You know, that facial expression over a computer screen, is it the same as a live face-to-face expression? And I think that some of these mental health issues and challenges that will come off the back of the global pandemic will be a real wake-up call for society.
And you were just sharing with me around the fact that you have to conduct now a lot of your business on Zoom calls and a different time zone. Do you have any insights in how you're trying to manage your team and make them feel good about themselves and valued about themselves in a situation where sometimes we're going to feel hopeless?
I think you carry on regardless. It's one of those ones, you know. It's the same. I try and act the same as I would as if I was stood in front of them. I hate the Zoom calls and Teams calls. Maybe that's a bit of my age.
I know it took you forever to get on this one.
No, for sure. and I spend most of my day doing them, which is a strange thing. You know, it's something that I never feel as comfy with. I mean, I'm a big reader of body language. I'm a big reader of facial expressions. Yeah. How somebody's, you know, holding themselves as a person, not just what they're saying. And I think when you're on a one-to-one Zoom call and it's that individual mentoring or support, I think it's okay. When you're on a big team call, I've been on several coaching webinars, even some USSF coaching webinars and live streams. There's been 80 people on there, and it just doesn't feel right. You know, it doesn't feel right. You want to be in front of an audience. You want to see the audience. You want to understand, get that feeling. And I think the sporting industry, I think everybody that's chosen, you know, the coaching vocation, you can feed off other people's energy. You can't feed off any energy on a computer, for me.
Yeah, that's actually very, that's really valid. I found that I enjoy this kind of interaction. And in recent months, though, when I've been on large group Zoom calls, I feel like people sometimes are competing to be heard. So the more extroverts thrust themselves forward just so their voice, their opinions are heard. And for myself, people who've listened to this, I'm quite open about being quite introverted. I don't like competing for attention. And I found actually I'm going more and more introverted and ironically and weirdly actually missing human interaction.
I'm desperately missing that. I've got to admit that, Angus. I mean, again, the industries that we've been in, every day is about meeting people, shaking people's hands, talking to people, you know, sharing problems, sharing challenges, you know, and I think, you know, that's sort of part of life. And via a computer screen is a little bit too clinical for me,
you know, 100%.
And that's sort of where we're at. And I think anything, you know, I think my mechanism with coping with, you know, if you like, the struggles and challenges, is to surround yourself with good people that you can talk, you can talk to. You can just, you know, it's quite strange because we talked about having this podcast and, you know, I said, oh, I'll put some notes down now. Really, we've just talked. So we haven't even really, you know, I think you threw me at the start with some of the questions. I thought we're talking about leadership here. We've ended up just sitting down in front of the computer and having a chat for whatever, an hour or so. And that's what it's
ended up. You're not the first guest to have said that.
But, you know, yeah. I think that's one of your tactics, I think.
Just lay a few traps out there, just get you comfortable, get you opening up a little bit.
I
don't think there is, and I think just to sum up that segment, there's a world of leadership out there that needs to really sit back and think about what you and I have just discussed, the very human element of social interaction.
Yeah.
And there's a generation out there, the millennial and post-millennial generations, that have done everything in their lives on smart tech. And those mental health issues are there. They're right there, right under the surface. And it comes back to what you were saying earlier about being a lifelong learner in your leadership role. We're now in a whole new world of social interaction and professional interaction. And we have to find ways to make sure our team's okay and able to move forward. And I think that's a massive burden on government as well. But we can put that one in a parking lot for another day, because I would like to ask you, and thank you for speaking to mental health, because a lot of people won't speak to it, even though they're aware of it. So good for you. So your leadership cake, I'm looking at my notes here, and your leadership cake is made up of the following attributes. So learning, humility, philanthropy, being respectful, being industrious, enabling and empowering people to do things, and being ethical, and being a person of good values, positive values. So with and that looks like quite a tasty leadership cake to chew on. So who out there?
Some sprinkling on top of that, Angus, would be, you know, treating people as individuals as well. You know, understanding that everybody is an individual, and I think that's huge, and that's massive, and that, you know, that falls into that, not just the mental health, but everything, even about performance. Treating other people, you know, as individuals, and getting to know them as people as much as whatever the task, whatever you're trying to do, you've got to know that person as a person first.
Which is where empathy comes into it.
Yep.
Yeah, yep, hundreds. Sure. So who in the world today do you see as the physical embodiment of those leadership attributes?
I don't know. I'd have to come back on a different podcast for that one.
Oh, okay. That's not Eddie Jones.
It's not the off-the-cuff answer. I mean, Eddie Jones for sure ticks a lot of those boxes.
Yeah.
And he's definitely one of my inspirational leaders. And, you know, for sure, you know, he would be up there. You know, and I think Alex Ferguson would be up there. You know, so out of the ones we've mentioned today, I think those two certainly would be around there. And you know, the more I read, the more I hear about Eddie Jones, the more and more he starts to fit into my current thinking. And it doesn't mean that he supersedes Sir Alex Ferguson. He just fits in where I am currently. And this is one of the challenges that I feel, that I use a range of different leadership styles and different people at certain circumstances. But I love what Eddie Jones says. He's a straight talker.
Yeah.
I think there's, you know, probably a little bit similar to myself, that, you know, there's people that certainly can articulate better educated than myself to talk about leadership, but I'll just tell you how it is and how I feel about it. And I do believe that there's a lot of things with Eddie Jones. So, you know, if you really do want to put me on the spot, that's my answer.
I have heard on the grapevine that he's got, by his bedside, he's got a book on John Dyke's coaching philosophies.
He's the only one then.
But I mean, when you look at him as a character, you know, he's an Australian by birth. He's coached Australia, he's coached South Africa, he's coached Japan, and now he's coached England, and every, he's, as a non-native of those countries, he's gone to all those countries and made their national teams and some of their professional teams a lot better organizations. So
because he's been true to Eddie Jones and not the country that he's worked in or the nationality that worked in. He said, it's me. I'm me, whatever. Wherever I'm working, these are still my values.
And that takes courage, doesn't it?
It does take courage. Yeah.
So we're coming to the end of the show, and these last two questions are designed to try and close out on a high and get you to... It's another one of my traps, John, get you to reveal a couple of personal things. So
you've got 5 minutes because I'm on another call.
Okay.
Well.
So my, there you go. My leadership luxuries, the two things that I've carried everywhere with me that helped me recalibrate and balance are music and reading. In terms of music, what would be the one song that you'd take with you on your leadership journey as you would continue to evolve And the second question is, what's the one luxury you would have around you all the times that enables you to be the leader that you want to be?
God, I mean, there's so many songs, but if I'm thinking it and I'm trying to tie it in with leadership and inspiration, and let's go Electric Light Orchestra, Wild West Hero.
Wow.
Let's do that. But that isn't the only one, by the way. You know, I would have there's hundreds, you know. I like a variety of different music, but let's go with that one. That's quite a nice go-to.
And your one luxury that will help you continue to be the leader that you want to be?
It's got to be a football, surely. Yeah, that speaks any language, any culture, because, you know, what the luxuries and the way that I cope with maybe some of the challenges of everything is, you know, learning a new language, exploring a new culture. And for me, you know, if you take that football with you, you know, that speaks 1,000 words, just the football on its own.
Awesome. Well, there we go. Thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your insights and thoughts. It's really good to have you. And I would just like to wish you well on your journey, and hopefully in the not too distant future, I can maybe visit your academy over in LA and we can grab a cup of coffee.
Angus, you're more than welcome anytime. I think you already know the answer to that. It would be great to catch up face to face. And as you can see here, we started off the conversation, it was light, it is now dark.
Yeah, I've watched it change, so I better let you go because it'll be nearly past your bedtime. So thank you very much, John.